Hello, my name's Dave Emery. This is For the Record, Program 195, Part 2. In this half hour, we're going to continue to analyze the hostile takeover bid by Vodafone of Mannesmann AG. Ultimately, that takeover bid, once other German corporations came to the aid of Mannesmann, was basically a German-style consensual deal, with Mannesmann retaining almost as much capital participation as Vodafone. We have been taking a look at a number of corporate maneuvers that were engaged in by Mannesmann, mostly in conjunction with not only German banks and corporations, but with corporations that had significant capital participation by other German firms, such as AOL, whose AOL Europe is a joint AOL Bertelsmann operation. Ultimately, Mannesmann was able to clinch an internet bank deal, as indicated in this. That deal was with Deutsche Bank, one of the top German financial institutions. Deutsche Bank, by the way, has a little less than 10% capital participation in AOL. This is from the Financial Times of London of January 29th and January 30th of the year 2000. This is an article by Ralph Atkins in Berlin, Tony Major in Frankfurt, and Alan Kane in London. It's headlined, Mannesmann clinches internet bank deal, subtitled Takeover Battle. Besieged German telecoms group joins Deutsche Bank to create pan-European service. The article reads in part as follows. Mannesmann, the German telecommunications group facing a hostile takeover bid from Vodafone AirTouch of the UK, is to join forces with Deutsche Bank to create a pan-European internet-based bank. The deal, unveiled yesterday, takes the development of Mannesmann's online activities a significant step forward as the bidding battle unleashed by Vodafone enters its final stages. The offer closes on February 7th. Mannesmann hopes the growth potential of ventures such as the initiative with Deutsche Bank, Germany's biggest, will swing shareholders in its favor. It argues Vodafone's offer, worth 158 billion euros at last night's close, undervalues Mannesmann's shares substantially. The German group is also considering a possible equity stake in AOL Europe, the internet service provider, and an alliance with Vivendi, the French telecoms and utilities group. Ultimately, it was the British who formed the alliance with Vivendi. As indicated, the ultimate resolution of the Mannesmann-Vodafone battle was much more a division of equals rather than a takeover by Vodafone, which would have been the first successful hostile takeover in light of the nationalistic and united agenda of German corporations. That would have been a first. That first has yet to take place, although there is speculation in international corporate and financial circles that one may yet take over. Ultimately, the final resolution, the Vodafone purchase of Mannesmann, was almost a division of equals. Reading now from the Financial Times of London of Tuesday, February 1st of the year 2000, this is an article by Peter Tall Larson in London, Ralph Atkins in Dusseldorf, and William Lewis in New York. It's headlined, Vodafone hints at 49.9% deal. Subtitled, Equity Offer to Mannesmann is Latest Move in Hostile Bid Battle Between Mobile Phone Groups. This reads in part as follows. Vodafone AirTouch and Mannesmann edged closer to a deal yesterday when the UK mobile phone group suggested it would be willing to give its German counterpart almost 50% of the equity in the combined group if the deal was recommended. Vodafone dropped its hint as equity markets digested news of the company's strategic alliance with Vivendi, the French communications and utilities group. At the close of trading, the spread between the value of Vodafone's hostile offer and Mannesmann's share price had shrunk to about 7%, its narrowest level since the bid was launched. Note, ultimately, this was the resolution. It was virtually a division of equals. And note, in the corporate maneuvering by Mannesmann and other German financial and corporate institutions, note how that maneuvering ultimately drove up the value of Mannesmann and permitted such a deal. It is just that sort of coordinated corporate action that distinguishes German corporate maneuvering from the corporate maneuvering of other countries. In our visits with Professor Wilhelm Stauffer of Stauffer Consultants, that is a pseudonym for an individual and a firm that advises companies in small European countries on matters European, they have an explicitly anti-fascist perspective, and in 1993 and 4, it was my pleasure and privilege to access Professor Stauffer's broadcast, and Professor Stauffer pointed out not only was it made virtually impossible by law for other companies to own a controlling interest in the German core corporations, some of those legal restrictions were touched on in the February 7th Reuters article with which I began the previous half hour. But the German corporations, with regard to their dealings in other countries, approach those countries' economies much the way NATO approached its aerial bombardment campaign in Yugoslavia in the spring and early summer of 1999. Just like the NATO air forces, primarily American, took out communications, rail, and energy facilities, and so forth, so too German corporations in dealing with other countries have bought out strategic heavy industry, energy, communications, and transportation, thereby gaining control of those countries' economies. And ultimately, as we've looked at, economic control leads to political control. And bear in mind the major German corporate purchases in this country, from the Daimler-Benz purchase of Chrysler to the German corporate control of American publishing by primarily Bertelsmann, with assistance from the von Holtzbrinck firm, both with documented connections to the Third Reich and readily apparent connections to a trained observer, to what I call the Underground Reich as well. In the wake of the Vodafone-Mannesmann deal, once again, Gerhard Schroeder, the German chancellor, began to stick his nose into corporate matters. This is, by the way, again, in sharp contrast with the way other political leaders have behaved. You haven't seen Clinton or Tony Blair lobbying on behalf of American corporations or British corporations when they face takeover by German corporations. That is one of the significant differences in the two countries, in German corporate maneuvering and those of other countries. We're going to turn now to the Financial Times of London of Tuesday, February 8th of the year 2000. This is an article by Haig Simonian in Norberstedt, and its headline, Schroeder Sets Up Takeover Study Group, subtitled Vodafone-Mannesmann Deal. Committee to consider amendments to code after first successful hostile bid. I think successful here belongs in quotes. Gerhard Schroeder, the German chancellor, yesterday announced plans to create a special committee to examine the consequences of Vodafone's successful bid for Mannesmann and advise on whether any legislation might be necessary to restrict such hostile takeovers in the future. So again, note that Gerhard Schroeder is sticking his nose into political matters, is sticking his political nose into economic matters again, and there has set up a group to study whether hostile takeover bids could be restricted in the future. As I've noted, this, quote, center-left government, unquote, note the quotes, in Germany, is the most nationalistic and chauvinistic government they've had in the post-World War II period. If the CDU was in the driver's seat in German politics, and they were engaging in the sort of very obviously nationalistic fashion that Germany has been behaving, both with regard to economic, political, and military matters, not only Europe, but much of the rest of the world would be up in arms. I think this this center-left government is little more than a front, and in particular, I think Joschka Fischer, the foreign minister, is a left-cover BND agent, BND being the German intelligence service, and the final incarnation of the Reinhard Gehlen Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit that I've dealt with so often. I would note that Joschka Fischer was the point man for the German peace movement when Helmut Kohl was engaging in negotiations with Gorbachev. Because of the apparent vitality of the German peace movement, Gorbachev okayed German reunification. No sooner did that happen than the German, quote, peace movement, unquote, metamorphosed along with Joschka Fischer into the German war in the Balkans movement, and we've dealt with the pivotal German role in the breakup of Yugoslavia in other broadcasts in the past, especially For the Record Program 150 and For the Record Program 154 in particular. In the aforementioned For the Record Program 187, we dealt with the heavy lobbying on behalf of the German/Brazilian candidate to become head of the IMF. The German government has been engaging in uncharacteristic lobbying on behalf of a fellow named Kyle Koch-Weser. I may be mispronouncing his name. Koch-Weser is his last name. Mr. Kyle Koch-Weser holds joint Brazilian and German citizenship, and he is the German choice to head up the International Monetary Fund. I would note in this regard that the joint Brazilian-German citizenship should certainly set a veteran listener and a knowledgeable observer to sniffing the air, and the odor that comes out of such joint Brazilian and German citizenship has a distinct Bormann tint to it. We're going to take a look in this in the remainder of this half-hour segment at other German corporate maneuvering, and in particular note the extreme nationalistic tone to this German corporate and economic maneuvering, and again the contrast with other countries' corporate maneuvering. More. And again, in the initial discussion of the German bid to get Mr. Kyle Kochweser appointed head of the IMF was in For the Record Program 187. And supplementing that discussion is an article from the Financial Times of London of Monday, January 17th of the year 2000. This is an article by Ed Crooks. It's headlined, Frontrunner for IMF Job Faces Powerful Opposition. Subtitled, Kochweser is the favorite, though only Berlin wants him. But a long struggle for succession could be worse. The article reads in part as follows. The race to succeed Michel Camdessous as managing director of the International Monetary Fund is a curious contest. Promising contenders are being kept out of it, and the current favorite, according to almost everyone but his backers, is unfit. Kyle Kochweser, a German finance ministry official who has spent 25 years with the World Bank, is the frontrunner, but he faces powerful opposition. Feelings about him in all the G7 capitals except Berlin range from grudging acceptance to hostility. The issue will be discussed at the Group of Seven Industrialized Nations Finance Ministers meeting in Tokyo next weekend, but will not be resolved there. The danger is that the IMF could see a long and damaging struggle for succession, as the World Trade Organization experienced last year. Governments and analysts argue that the IMF's failure to prevent the financial crises in Asia and Russia shows it urgently needs reform, which cannot be achieved without strong leadership. Note the following paragraph. The German government has stepped up a gear in its support for Mr. Kochweser. Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder is writing to all 24 of the IMF's executive directors. Today in Berlin, 40 foreign ambassadors will be briefed by Mr. Schroeder's chief foreign policy advisor. But on Friday night, Larry Summers, U.S. Treasury Secretary, dropped heavy hints that he would not support the German campaign. The new head of the IMF must have, quote, stature, expertise, ability to command global support, and commitment to a process of ongoing reform, unquote, he said. Mr. Summers has said he wants an IMF that is much more focused on crisis prevention and resolution, and much less involved in long-term lending for development, a role that does not suit Mr. Kochweser's experience. Washington also doubts that Mr. Kochweser possesses the necessary intellect and negotiating skills to handle complex negotiations with governments in financial crisis. I would note that third world countries and Russia also that had borrowed from the IMF were the focal point of much of the anxiety that beset world capital markets in the fall of 1998 when many feared that there would be an international financial collapse keyed by a collapse of the U.S. equities market, basically Wall Street. Ultimately, the role of the IMF in the world's capitalist economies is one of the things that makes this such a very sensitive issue. And again, I want to note the altogether distinct German nationalistic role in with regard to this, this contrasting sharply again with the corporate and economic policies of other countries. Turning now to the Financial Times of London of Monday, January 31st of the year 2000, more about Gerhard Schroeder's lobbying on behalf of Mr. Kyle Kochweser. This is an article by Lionel Barber in Davos, and it's headlined, Schroeder puts pressure on Clinton for German to win top IMF job. This reads in part as follows. German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder has sharply stepped up pressure to insert a fellow countryman in the top job at the International Monetary Fund with a personal appeal to U.S. President Bill Clinton. Mr. Schroeder telephoned Mr. Clinton last week and told him that winning the IMF job for Kyle Kochweser, a former World Bank executive, was, quote, vital to U.S.-German relations, unquote, according to officials from both countries familiar with the conversation. A very interesting way to put that, Mr. Clinton's support for Mr. Kyle Kochweser was vital to U.S.-German relations. Continuing, the chancellor reinforced his message with a warning that the German government would veto Laurent Fabius, the former Fabius, F-A-B-I-U-S, the former French prime minister, and Andrew Crockett, the British monetary official, each of whom has been floated as a possible candidate. And again, note the highly characteristic German nationalistic approach to this issue, and that contrasts sharply with other countries' approach. Continuing, Mr. Schroeder's intervention underlines the degree to which he has put his personal prestige on the line in an attempt to ensure that Mr. Kochweser takes over the top IMF job from Michel Camdessous, who is due to step down shortly. Mr. Camdessous's last name, capital C-A-M-D-E-S-S-U-S. Continuing, U.S. and European officials at the Davos International Forum acknowledged that Mr. Schroeder's campaign made it harder to veto Mr. Kalkwasser in spite of reservations in the U.S. Treasury and the U.K. and French governments about his relatively low profile and his background in development rather than international finance. And apparently the lobbying campaign by Gerhard Schroeder has ultimately borne very successful fruit. We're going to turn now to the Financial Times of London of Tuesday, February 1st of the year 2000, and note how the lobbying effort appears, as I said, to be bearing fruit. This is an article by Lionel Barber in Davos, and it's headlined, Lobbying Places German in Pole Position to Head IMF. This is subtitled, Kalkwasser Candidacy, Schroeder Frustrated That Job Has Been French Preserve. This article reads in part as follows. The contest for the leadership of the International Monetary Fund has entered a diplomatic endgame amid signs that Kayo Kalkwasser, the German candidate, is moving into pole position. A month ago, Mr. Kalkwasser was widely written off as a little-known former World Bank executive lacking the stature to succeed Michel Camdessous, the French managing director of the IMF, who is due to step down shortly. But Mr. Kalkwasser's chances are improving, thanks to a personal lobbying campaign by Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder. He telephoned President Bill Clinton last week to say that he considered winning the IMF post was, quote, vital, unquote, for U.S.-German relations. Mr. Schroeder used similar strong-arm tactics in a recent meeting in Paris with Lionel Jospin, the French prime minister. Meanwhile, Gordon Brown, U.K. finance minister, has offered to help the Kalkwasser campaign, contradicting reports that he was interested in the IMF job. The intensity of the German campaign has surprised U.S. and European officials at this year's Davos International Forum. But the German government is frustrated that the IMF job has long been a French preserve. And note that, although as I speak, on the evening of February 20th of the year 2000, although the issue is not resolved, it certainly looks as though Mr. Kalkwasser is going to get the job. Certainly I would note that the European Union has now closed ranks behind Mr. Kalkwasser, and as we've looked at in the past, the European Monetary Union is, in effect, the realization of the theories and plans of Friedrich Liest, who was a pan-German theoretician and economist, who envisioned an economically unified Europe under German domination as a vehicle for effecting world political conquest. That, in turn, was that at the time was directed at the United Kingdom, which was the dominant power on Earth. The plan has finally been realized with the realization of the European Monetary Union. However, it is a different Anglo-Saxon power, the United States of America, that is in the world driver's seat, and it is directed at us. Note in that context the following story. This is from the New York Times of Tuesday, February 15th of the year 2000. This is an article by Joseph Kahn, K-A-H-N. It's datelined Washington, January 14th, and headlined, Europeans Move Toward Backing German to Lead the IMF. The article reads in part as follows. The European Union appears set to back a German finance ministry official to head the International Monetary Fund, giving a boost to a candidate Clinton administration officials privately argue is ill-suited for the job. European foreign ministers, meeting in Brussels today, reached an informal consensus that Kayo Kalkwasser, 55, a longtime World Bank official who currently serves as a state secretary in the German finance ministry, should succeed Michel Camdessous as director of the Monetary Fund, German and European officials said after the meeting. The French, who had been viewed as cool to Mr. Kalkwasser, issued a statement saying that they would not block a European choice. The Brussels meeting was a success for Germany, which has sought to foster a sense of inevitability about Mr. Kalkwasser's bid to take over the IMF's leadership. Though European foreign ministers sent signals today that they had rallied around the German choice, they put off until at least February 28th any official declaration that the European Union would have put its political muscle behind his candidacy. That gives Germany 2 weeks to rally support for him without risking a loss of face by the Europeans if it were unable to do so. The turn of events is considered a setback for the Clinton administration. It publicly remains neutral on Mr. Kalkwasser, but the administration has made clear that it would prefer that Europe, which has customarily named the head of the Monetary Fund, find someone who is better known internationally and who has more experience managing currencies and setting overall economic strategy. The quiet disagreement has persisted for 4 months. This next paragraph is very important in terms of understanding the overall economic stakes, economic matters at stake here. The leadership change at the Monetary Fund comes at a sensitive time. The fund, which is based in Washington, has more influences than ever, The fund, which is based in Washington, has more influences than ever before over capitalist-oriented economies worldwide. From Indonesia to Russia, the IMF not only provides billions of dollars in aid and helps shape economic policies, but can also affect the political fortunes of leaders who defy its lending conditions. I would also note that as the financial crisis in the capital markets in the fall of 1998 indicated, the IMF and its machinations, and this is not to say that the IMF is free of fault, far from it, the IMF is seriously in need of reform. There's no indication that Mr. Kochvaser is interested in reform. But as the financial crises and the crisis in particular on Wall Street in the fall of 1998 demonstrated, the IMF and its role in as a lending vehicle for much of the world's economies also wields tremendous influence over the major capitalist economies as well. Basically, what's at stake here is an increased German influence, not only in the world economy, but over the equity markets. And in, behind Mr. Kochvaser, I think a knowledgeable observer would certainly detect the hand of the Bormann Group. And this basically would put a Bormann man in an underground Reich man as the head of the IMF and put that individual in a position to take decisive or to take very important actions with regard to the world economy. As noted in a For the Record program about German control over the European economies, one of the results of the German occupation of Europe in World War II was to basically provide the German corporations with effective control over the post-World War II European economy. And it is that post-war control that ultimately has given the Germans the clout in turning the European Monetary Union into a German entity. And when one sees the European Union basically closing ranks behind Mr. Kaio Kochvaser, one should bear in mind that German control over the European economy. Due to limitations of time, we can't go into that in any great detail, but returning once again to the Paul Manning book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, we can touch on just a little bit of this, this dealing with the German corporate control behind the scenes and through the Bormann Group of the French economy. Turning to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, we read, "The characteristic secrecy surrounding the actions of German industrialists and bankers during the final 9 months of the war, when Bormann's flight capital program held their complete attention, was also carried over into the post-war years when they began pulling back the skeins of economic wealth and power that stretched out to neutral nations of the world and to formerly occupied lands. There was a suggestion of this in France. Flora Lewis, writing from Paris in the New York Times of August 28, 1972, told of her conversation with a French publisher, quote, "It would not be possible to trace ownership of corporations and the power structure as in the United States. Quote, they, unquote, would not permit it. Quote, they, unquote, would find a way to hound and torture anyone who tried," unquote, commented the publisher. "They, unquote, seem to be a fairly small group of people who know each other, but many are not at all known to the public. They, unquote, move in and out of government jobs, but public service apparently serves to win private promotion rather than the other way around. The government, quote, control, unquote, that practically everyone mentions cannot be traced through stock holdings, regulatory agencies, or public decisions. It seems to function through a maze of personal contacts and tacit understandings. The understandings arrived at in the power structure of Europe reach back to pre-war days, were continued during the occupation, and have carried over to the present time." Lewis, in her report from Paris, commented further, quote, "This hidden control of government and corporations has produced a general unease in Paris," unquote, and it has produced a behind-the-scenes German control over the European Union and European Monetary Union, and that was one of the things, no doubt, that has cemented the EU's backing of Kaio Kochvaser. One of the relatively few areas of resistance or acts of resistance against German corporate takeovers has come from Poland, as evidenced in the Financial Times of London of Thursday, February 3rd of the year 2000. This is an article by Christopher Bobinski, B-O-B-I-N-S-K-I, in Warsaw, headlined, Polish bank bars German rival's executive, and it reads in part as follows. A representative of Deutsche Bank, which claims to have won control of Poland's BIG, Bank Gdański, at a shareholders' meeting last week, was yesterday barred from entering its Warsaw headquarters. Skipping down, Herbert Januszewski, the Deutsche Bank nominee for chief executive of BIG-BG, protested that he had been unable to enter the BIG-BG building yesterday. Skipping down again, quote, we had a wave of withdrawals in Poznan, in Bydgoszcz on Monday and Tuesday, and the same thing happened in Gdansk yesterday, unquote, Mr. Kott said on Wednesday. That's Bogusław Kott, the bank's founder, last name K-O-T-T. Concern among the bank's clients, faced with the prospects of two rival supervisory boards and management teams, was heightened by the fact that the trading in BIG-BG's shares has been suspended by market authorities until the close of the shareholders' meeting. The dispute over control of the bank has become highly politicized. Representatives of Alexander Kwasniewski, the president, have signaled their dismay at what they call a hostile takeover bid by Deutsche Bank. That man's last name, by the way, K-A-S-N-I-E-W-S-K-I. So again, that Polish resistance to the Deutsche Bank takeover of BIG-BG, one of the relatively few examples of a nationalistic response on the part of a country whose entities are being taken over by German corporate entities, that contrasts sharply with the German response. More on the highly nationalistic way in which corporate Germany and the political structure allied with it are responding to attempts to change the European economy. This, by the way, the behavior of German banks was alluded to in the Reuters story of February 7th, with which we began the program in our first half-hour segment. This final article is from the Financial Times of London of Friday, January 28th of the year 2000. It's by Deborah Hargraves in Brussels, headlined, German Regions Threaten Block on EU Reforms Deal. Subtitled, State Governments Give Brussels Ultimatum Over Action Against Landesbanks. And this reads in part as follows. Germany's regional governments have threatened to block agreement on the EU's institutional reforms and enlargement process if Brussels continues to take action against the country's regional public banks, the Landesbanks. In a meeting yesterday with Mario Monti, the EU's competitive commissioner, representatives of four regional governments accused the European Commission of attacking the public sector in Germany. Henning Scherf, head of the Bremen legislature, told Mr. Monti that Germany's 15 Länder, or states, were united in their concerns about Brussels' actions. He said that they could use their power in the Bundesrat, the German upper house, which is made up of representatives from the Länder governments, to block EU initiatives. So again, note the highly nationalistic and idiosyncratic German behavior in economic matters, contrasting very sharply with most countries' responses. I've alluded to various programs that are available from a tape duplication service. The name of that service is Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They can be reached by regular mail at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. The email address is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. There's a list of and description of the various tapes available from Spitfire on the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com, which is equipped with real audio so the listeners can listen to the tapes going out to the various stations that carry the program the week that they are going out. There's a matching list on the KFJC website at kfjc.org. Look in the Transmissions and Public Affairs section. KFJC.org is also equipped with audio so that listeners can hear the program that I do from 7 to 10 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday night and 6 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, also Pacific Time. I get a small royalty from the sale of the archive shows only. I get no monies from recent, present, or future on-air endeavors. That concludes this half-hour segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.